From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, tensions in Burkina Faso, the latest on the Ebola outbreak, deadly border attack on the Pakistani side of the border with India, plus the U.S. election just around the corner. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Burkina Faso's army, which seized power Friday, cleared thousands of protesters from the capital, Ouagadougou, opened fire at a state television headquarters on Sunday, killing at least one person as it sought to restore order following the resignation of longtime President Blaise Compaoré. Mr. Compaoré's 27-year rule in the former French colony ended Friday after 2 days of mass protest against his bid to change the constitution to seek a third presidential term. He fled to Ivory Coast and the army stepped in to fill the power vacuum. Signs of discontent emerged on Sunday after the military named Lieutenant Colonel Yakuba Isaac Zida to head a transitional government as protesters demanded a return to civilian rule in the West African country.
The most great democracies of the world are governed by the civil, there is no military.
This demonstrator, who like others, voiced their opposition to Zida. He said the biggest democracies in the world are governed by civilians, not by soldiers. On Sunday, the army said it would install a unity government to oversee a political transition spawned by Compaoré's ouster.
You know, African, la CDAO.
Head of the United Nations Office for West Africa, Mohamed Ibn Chambras, joined the United States and the African Union in rejecting the army's seizure of power, but expressed cautious optimism about a return to civilian rule. Nearly every African head of state swore in their oath of office to defend their nation's constitution. But constitutional scholars in Africa say they are seeing two trends. One, a disturbing tendency for African leaders to try to change the constitution to stay in power. And two, a wave of public protest in defense of the constitution. VOA's Anita Powell looks at the continental trend.
In the last decade, at least a dozen African leaders, among them the rulers of Algeria, Cameroon, Chad, Djibouti, Uganda, and Zimbabwe, have amended their national constitutions to allow them to extend their time in office. The men who lead those six countries have been in power collectively for just shy of 150 years. The latest attempt to prolong power came from Burkina Faso's leader of 27 years, Blaise Compaoré. His recent attempts to extend his rule through constitutional amendment were met with fierce resistance in the capital, Ouagadougou, and eventually military intervention. Constitutional scholars and analysts see this as a worrying trend, and one that has little justification. David Bilchitz is a law professor at the University of Johannesburg, and has dedicated much of his career to studying constitutions. He notes that just because African leaders have adapted from the old tactic of taking power by coup to the more sophisticated strategy of maintaining power through constitutional change, well, that doesn't make it right.
I think we must distinguish, and it's a very important distinction to make in the context of some of the developments in African in relation to constitutions, is the use of formal legal processes often to mask what is substantively undemocratic.
James Stent is a researcher at Good Governance Africa, a think tank. He says changing the constitution to stay in power is not good governance.
This is a pretty typical example of bad governance. The AU, in fact, stands against the extension of presidential limits. There's really no legal or moral basis in which to extend rule beyond the constitutional limits.
Increasingly, the public is losing its tolerance for bad governance. Stent notes that the growing trend for Africa's citizens to push back is positive.
The outrage is encouraging. It means, for one, that people are more aware of their rights in a democracy, and perhaps also that these stories of resistance to regimes being successful, as if we saw in the Arab Spring, that citizens who previously may have been unwilling to stand up to the government for fear of reprisals from the state are now more willing to do so and are willing to stand up for democratic processes.
The experts say not all efforts to extend power are necessarily bad. Bilchitz noted that the late U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt ran for re-election 3 times, defying what was then American political tradition to steer his nation through World War II. Roosevelt died during his 4th term in office, and the U.S. Constitution was later amended to limit future presidents to 2 4-year terms in office. Such cases, Bilchitz said, are extraordinary, like a recent decision by Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf to suspend October's special senatorial elections because of the nation's Ebola crisis. This act drew allegations of abuse from her critics. It was a tough call, says Bilchitz.
Well, I think Liberia is undergoing a tremendously trying time, an emergency which is affecting the health and very livelihoods of the people. And so there may be a case for not having an election right at this moment, and postponing it under some exception, but that would be for a very limited period and for a very limited purpose.
The trend of constitutional tinkering does not appear to be slowing. Recently, the leaders of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Rwanda, and Burundi, 3 neighbors at the nexus of what is surely the most blood-soaked patch of this continent, all have been accused of looking to the Constitution for an extension. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Also in the news, the African Governance Initiative, a support group set up by former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, warns Ebola is spreading up to 9 times faster in parts of Sierra Leone than just 2 months ago. Meanwhile, a 5th doctor in Sierra Leone has tested positive for the deadly virus. More than 500 health workers have contracted Ebola since March, and about half of them have died. France says a UN employee suffering from Ebola has been flown to France from Sierra Leone there for treatment. Appearing on U.S. television Sunday, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power praised American and British efforts for helping turn the tide against Ebola in Liberia.
More and more people are getting educated. There's social mobilization that's now stretching out into the countryside. And I just got off the phone this morning with the head of the UN operation in the region, and he's done a full tour into the countryside, and he said wherever we have an Ebola treatment unit, a lab, and social mobilization, infection rates are coming way down. Where we don't, they're not. It's that simple.
And Power, just back from West Africa, says awareness campaigns are more effective throughout Liberia. She also spoke about the biggest need in the fight against Ebola.
The number one need, I would say, is health professionals, nurses. Jim Kim from the World Bank came out a couple days ago and said as many as 5,000 would be needed in the coming months. That's a large number when you think about how many people have to take away from their practices, make themselves available for 3 or 4 weeks. Right now, the Ebola treatment units that the United States is helping build in the countries in the region are staffed. Most of the NGOs you talk to can say, okay, we can see the next month getting covered in terms of healthcare workers, but we don't know what we're going to do for the month after that.
U.S. military team in Liberia has set up mobile labs to test for the virus. They've built a 25-bed hospital for health workers and building Ebola treatment units. U.S. deployment is expected to grow to between 3,200 and 3,900 personnel. And Britain has dispatched 750 military personnel to fight the disease in Sierra Leone. The epidemic has killed more than 4,900 people. Last week, the World Health Organization said data from a range of sources, including funeral directors and treatment centers, indicates a slowdown in infections, but the medical charity Doctors Without Borders has warned estimates could be unreliable and underreported. Meantime, the WHO is issuing updated guidelines on personal protective equipment, or PPE, to be used in the fight against Ebola. They say these guidelines will be helped to protect healthcare workers from infection, but it notes that the use of PPP is only one tool in the effort to prevent transmission of Ebola. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization says PPE is only one in a whole range of tools needed to combat Ebola, many of which are more important than the choice of covering by healthcare workers. These, it says, include the administrative and organizational setup for healthcare facilities, ventilation within these facilities, water and sanitation, and a host of approaches to assure nurses and doctors they can treat patients safely without infecting themselves and others. Director of Service Delivery and Safety at WHO, Edward Kelly, says research into how healthcare workers have been infected in this current Ebola outbreak shows the choice of PPE is much less important than the way it is used.
It has not been the choice of the PPE that has caused the infection. It has been the way that that PPE is put on and taken off. So the importance of appropriate training is highlighted in this document. It also lays out a set of principles around how some broad principles around how PPE should be used. And the use correctly putting on and taking off, and the training of health workers in using these, which would include mentoring and really engaging both before and during care, is fundamental.
The WHO guidelines cover five basic areas. Dr. Kelly says the most important recommendation is for health workers to completely cover the mucous membranes of their eyes, mouth, and nose in order to prevent virus exposure. He says health workers should use either a face shield or goggles and a fluid-resistant medical surgical mask that is structured so it does not collapse against the mouth while caring for Ebola patients. He says appropriate hand washing or use of a disinfectant is crucial in preventing the infection from spreading. But he says doing this in the field can be extremely difficult. Therefore, he says, the WHO recommends double gloving and suggests how health workers should handle hand hygiene when they leave the area.
There's an absolute recommendation on double gloving, which did not exist before. It's a detail, but we also recommend the type of gloves, which are nitrile gloves. Latex gloves are discouraged. Those of you know, latex tends to cause, there's a lot of irritation and problems with the use of that sometimes.
The guidelines also have recommendations on gowns, coveralls, and aprons, as well as appropriate footwear and head cover. WHO suggests healthcare workers use one set of PPE per shift and dispose infectious waste in leak-proof bags and in covered bins. In the case of non-disposable items, such as rubber boots, there are guidelines on cleaning and disinfecting. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With the landing on civilians.
And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
All that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Iraq says Islamic State extremists have executed more than 300 members of an Iraqi tribe in Anbar province, including 50 women and children whose bodies were found stuffed in a water well. Witnesses are quoted as saying the killings were ongoing Sunday and included the massacre of 50 people from the targeted Sunni Al-Munimber tribe. 50 others were reported killed on Saturday. Additionally, Iraqi human rights officials speaking Sunday said 65 members of the tribe had been kidnapped after battling Islamic State fighters for weeks before running out of ammunition. Iraqi state television and Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi had ordered airstrikes on extremist positions. The provincial police chief in the Pakistani city of Lahore saying the death toll in a suicide bombing at an India-Pakistan border crossing has risen to more than 45. The Pakistan Taliban claim responsibility. Pakistan's Deputy Inspector General of Police Operations, Haider Ashraf, said 60 people are injured. He said they need to do three things, that is, secure the crime scene, identify the dead bodies, and hand them over to their relatives. He said many of the dead are children. An unnamed senior Pakistan commander said he believes the attack was carried out in response to the Pakistan Army's operation against Islamic militants in the tribal areas along the border with Afghanistan. India stepped up its security after that attack on Sunday. No Indian troops were hurt in the incident. Indian security expert, retired wing commander Praful Bakshi, spoke with Reuters.
We must understand that Pakistan is at the moment probably reaping the same fruit what they sowed. You see, they gave birth to this sort of system to carry out in India the terrorist activities. Now they are suffering the malady they're suffering what they gave birth to.
India and Pakistan have fought three wars and remain locked in a bitter conflict over the region of Kashmir, which both sides claim. In other news, a special tribunal in Bangladesh has handed down the death sentence to a senior leader of the country's largest Islamist party for war crimes more than 40 years ago. The crimes court in Dhaka found that Mir Qasim Ali guilty on Sunday for crimes committed during the nation's independence war against Pakistan in 1971 when he was commander of the Al-Badr militia forces. 62-year-old media tycoon is thought to be one of the top financiers of the Jamaat Islami Party. He was found guilty on 8 charges, including the abduction of a young man and the killing of him in a torture cell. Ali's defense lawyer describes the charges as baseless and false and vowed to appeal the verdict in the Supreme Court. Bangladesh's local collaborators and Pakistani soldiers killed 3 million people, raped 200,000 women, and displaced about 10 million to refugee camps in neighboring India during the country's independent struggle. Jamaat Islami opposed independence. Unprecedented talks among Myanmar's political rivals and powerful armies have led to commitments to discuss political reform and police talks in the still fractured country. Details now from VOA's Steve Herman in our Southeast Asia Bureau.
Myanmar's president, the country's military chief, and opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi were the key figures at a first-of-its-kind meeting at a time when the political reform process appears to have stalled. Presidential spokesman Ye Thut says the military brass and political rivals at the meeting agreed to discuss the issue of amending the constitution in parliament according to the law. He did not specify which articles of the Constitution would be up for debate. The National League for Democracy wants to change the constitutional prohibition on anyone becoming president whose spouse or children are foreign nationals. Suu Kyi's late husband was British, as are her two sons. Her NLD was victorious in an election in 1990, but the military ignored the results. The NLD boycotted an election 4 years ago at a time Suu Kyi was under house arrest. The military retains one quarter of the legislative seats, allowing it to block constitutional changes. Some lawmakers want to amend the constitution to remove this veto power. The get-together in Naypyidaw was apparently the first time Myanmar's powerful armed forces chief, Senior General Min Aung Hlaing, held a discussion with Suu Kyi. Some expressed skepticism about the gathering, noting only 6 of the country's 70 opposition parties were invited and only a few ethnic groups. The hastily arranged meeting occurred just hours after U.S. President Barack Obama made separate telephone calls to Myanmar's president and to opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The White House says the president stressed to Mr. Thein Sein the need for an inclusive and credible process for next year's elections. Mr. Obama also called on his counterpart to reduce communal tensions and achieve a nationwide ceasefire in the short term. He specifically mentioned the tensions and humanitarian situation in Rakhine State, where minority Muslim Rohingya face discrimination and violence at the hands of the majority Buddhists. U.S. Ambassador to Myanmar Derek Mitchell, speaking to VOA's Burmese service, expressed concern about the state of reform in the country.
There are some things that have gone back, some things that are not moving at all, and some things that have advanced.
The U.S. president is scheduled to visit Myanmar for November's ASEAN meeting and the East Asia Summit. Webster University professor Jason Briggs at the school's Bangkok campus says U.S. pressure in the upcoming summit may have influenced the timing for Friday's unusual meeting in Myanmar's capital.
It's a priority for the United States. I think that they're getting out ahead maybe of this issue being discussed at the summit.
Myanmar was under absolute military control from 1962 until 2010. Retired Army General Thein Sein has been president since 2011, following a four-year stint as prime minister. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Across the United States, candidates are making final pleas for votes ahead of midterm elections on Tuesday. VOA's Michael Bowman reports the latest public opinion surveys show an electorate that seems to be swinging towards Republicans as campaigning draws to a close.
It is crunch time for candidates seeking to rally supporters and convince any remaining undecided voters. Georgia Democratic Senate candidate Michelle Nunn.
We are reminding everybody about their power to make a difference in this election by getting out and voting.
Both parties have deployed their biggest names to the campaign trails. Former Republican presidential contenders Mitt Romney and John McCain. And on the Democratic side, former President Bill Clinton and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Notably absent from most Democratic campaigns, President Obama, whose declining approval numbers have vulnerable Democratic lawmakers distancing themselves from the White House.
It's good to be back in Michigan.
Even so, Mr. Obama did make a campaign appearance in Michigan last week.
I want to tell you why you need to vote. This country has made real progress since the worst economic crisis of our lifetimes. Over the past 4.5 years, we have seen American businesses create more than 10 million new jobs. Over the past 6 months, our economy has grown at the fastest pace in more than 10 years.
Political analyst Norm Ornstein.
Barack Obama finds himself in the same kind of position that Bush did 6 years ago. For an awful lot of his own candidates, persona non grata, except for raising money. They love the money. They don't want to have the president side by side with them.
Republicans, on the other hand, are eager to tie their Democratic opponents to the president. Senate candidate Scott Brown in New Hampshire.
The Obama-Shaheen agenda ends right here, right now.
Republicans are widely expected to retain control of the House of Representatives. In the Senate, they would need a net gain of 6 seats to seize control from Democrats.
We have a fairly clear idea that the trends favor, as they would normally, the Republican Party. The party out of the presidency does well in midterms. It's a tough road for Democrats. There's a route to get to keeping your majority. Republicans have multiple routes to taking a majority.
Democrats tout a massive voter mobilization effort they say will prove the polls wrong. Republicans, meanwhile, are sounding increasingly confident of victory on Tuesday. As always, those who show up to vote get the final say. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
And one last story. Kenya's Wilson Kipsang and Mary Kitani won the top men's and women's titles at the New York City Marathon on Sunday. Kipsang won the 42-kilometer race in an unofficial time of 2 hours, 10 minutes, and 59 seconds. Ethiopia's Lalisa Desisa came in second, finishing just 4 seconds behind. Kipsang has now taken the top spots in the Berlin, London, and New York City races. Mary Kitani of Kenya won the women's title, finishing in unofficial time of 2 hours, 25 minutes and 7 seconds, just 3 seconds ahead of fellow countrywoman Jemima Jellagat. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Sidrak Franklin, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On November 3rd, 644, Umar ibn al-Khattab, the second Muslim caliph, was killed by a Persian captive in Medina. Umar, who is regarded as the architect of the Islamic Empire, had taken over a large part of Persia. He is considered one of the most influential figures in Islamic history. In 1534, the English Parliament passed the Act of Supremacy, making King Henry VIII head of the Church of England, thus removing the official church in England from the realm of Roman Catholicism. Henry had sought the separation after the Pope refused to grant him a divorce. On this date in 1903, Panama declared its independence from Colombia. A treaty was quickly signed, granting the United States possession of the Panama Canal Zone, a waterway connecting the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. The canal opened in 1914. In 1911, one of the world's most recognized brands of American automobiles entered the market to compete with the Ford Model T. Co-founded by Louis Chevrolet and William C. Durant, Chevrolet unveiled the Classic 6 touring sedan. In 1957, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik 2, the second spacecraft launched into Earth orbit, and the first to carry a living animal, a dog named Laika. Also on this day in 1957, the song At the Hop was released by a rock group known as Danny and the Juniors. The Hop went to number one thanks in part to the group's appearance on American Bandstand, a national TV show featuring pop music and dancing. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Winter is on Syria's doorstep. For millions of the country's civilians, this means that an already difficult existence will become much, much worse. They must winterproof their shelters or build new ones, but building materials are scarce. Most of the refugees need cold weather clothing, extra blankets, and heating fuel, all of which are in short supply. And many worry about procuring medicines for their children's common winter illnesses. According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, of Syria's population of 22 million, at least 6.5 million people are internally displaced, while about 3.2 million have fled to neighboring countries. And as fighting in Syria escalates, these numbers continue to grow. Syria used to be a middle-class country where nearly every child was in school. In 2008, Syria's people were hosting refugees from neighboring countries, said Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration, Ann Richard. I never imagined that this land, so rich in history and antiquities, wheat and olive trees, could be so utterly broken. The Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees estimates that at least $6.5 billion is needed to meet these people's needs through the rest of the year. The United States is heeding the call, as it has over the past 3 years. Just 1 month ago, Secretary of State John Kerry pledged nearly $500 million in new assistance for humanitarian relief to Syria and for those countries that are hosting Syrian refugees. The majority of these funds will go to UN agencies. And in late October, Assistant Secretary Richard announced that the U.S. will provide another $10 million to help address the needs of local communities hosting refugees from Syria. More than half of Syria's refugees live outside of traditional refugee camps. This brings the total U.S. humanitarian contribution to the Syrian crisis to more than $2.9 billion since the beginning of the conflict. It is the largest sum we have spent on any humanitarian response in a generation. The United States is committed to providing relief for the millions of people affected by the worst humanitarian disaster of our era, and we hope that other nations will follow our lead.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.